Author Nathan Lean identifies what he sees as a rising tide of anti-Muslim sentiment in North America and Europe. And joining us now for more on his findings in Washington, D.C., Nathan Lean, research director at the Bridge Initiative at Georgetown University and the author of The Islamophobia Industry. Nathan, it's good of you to be on TVO tonight. Tell us what motivated you to write this book, first off.
Sure. Well, Steve, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. In the summer of 2010, when people here in the United States were involved in sort of the hue and cry over the Ground Zero Mosque, which wasn't a mosque and wasn't at Ground Zero, I became curious about the growth of anti-Muslim prejudice in the United States. And as I looked into some of the individuals and groups that were behind that sort of orchestrated controversy, it became clear to me that while I think a significant number of people here in the United States and elsewhere around the world do have sort of legitimate concerns about violence carried out by Muslims around the world, there is a network that exists expressly for the purpose of whipping up fervor.
And you've called it an industry. Why use that word?
Well, I call it an industry. It's not an industry in the same way that, for instance, the automobile industry is an industry, but it is an industry in the sense that you have dozens of individuals and groups here in the United States and Europe that are connected. They share funding well into the tens of millions of dollars. The Center for American Progress reported that over the course of 10 years, more than $42 million went to seven different groups. And the Council on American Islamic Relations has said that between 2008 and 2011, that number is actually closer to 120 million. So these groups are heavily funded. They're often comprised of sort of armchair scholars, American bloggers like Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer, who form sort of, I would say, pop-up nonprofit groups expressly for the purpose of advancing anti-Muslim prejudice into society, and they're pretty successful at it.
Do you doubt that they are genuine in their beliefs about what they preach?
No, I don't doubt that they're genuine in their beliefs at all. I think they are very concerned about what they see as an Islamic problem, but the issue that I have is the degree to which they take episodes of violence carried out by Muslims around the world and then make generalizations about the Islamic faith on the whole or writ large. I think that's something that is harmful to ordinary Muslim Americans, ordinary Muslim Canadians, and others around the world.
And what do you think their political goals are?
Well, it's a really complicated question, and they're not necessarily the same for any one individual. I think, quite honestly, a lot of the sort of ideological bent comes from very sort of hardcore or fervent pro-Israel beliefs. And so oftentimes what we see is that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is sort of refracted through this nasty political narrative in the United States here, where we see groups like Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer's AFDI, the American Freedom Defense Initiative, going to bat for candidates that they think will be tougher when it comes to that conflict or that will side with Israel. We see, in some cases, the evangelical Christian community getting on board, where you have activist sort of networks throughout the heartland of the country that are very much involved in realizing the success of proposed anti-Sharia bills. In fact, the head of one of the largest groups here in the United States, Act for America, Brigitte Gabriel, is herself a Christian with evangelical beliefs, but has as her field director for Act for America the former field director of the Christian Coalition. So there are a lot of sort of different overlaps here, but those are just a few examples.
Okay, but let me follow up on the Geller-Spencer duo. They were in Toronto not too long ago, and just out of interest, I went to see them speak because I'd heard how controversial they were. And I don't know, Nathan, you know, it's a fairly pro-Israel speech, which is not illegal, although some days it's harder than other days to be pro-Israel nowadays. You know, there are a lot of things happening in the name of Islam around the world that are of great concern to a lot of people, and they, of course, mention those. But what do you find so nefarious about what they're up to?
Well, First, I think your points are absolutely right. If you look at a group like the American Freedom Defense Initiative, I think what you see when you dig a little bit deeper is that despite the fact that they're sort of articulate and deliver this lofty language of freedom of speech and, you know, basic sort of Western and especially American rights, is that they are more actively engaged in promoting kind of a hateful worldview of Muslims here in the United States. This is the group that, mind you, was behind the Ground Zero Mosque controversy. The American Freedom Defense Initiative organized that protest in Manhattan. This happens to be the same group that has spent hundreds of thousands of dollars running bus ads here in Washington, D.C., in major metropolitan cities across the United States, disparaging Muslims, taking cherry-picking verses out of the Quran, plopping them alongside imagery of 9/11, and advancing the idea that there's something especially violent about Islam. One of the more recent bus advertisements referred to Islamic Jew hatred as being in the Quran. This is the same group that most recently in Garland, Texas, hosted the Draw Muhammad art exhibition, is what they called it. It was a cartoon contest where they used a generous portion of their funding, $10,000, to essentially award prize money to the cartoon that won. This was quite controversial and, in fact, provoked an attack in which two would-be ambushers were killed by police, and it ignited here in the United States this sort of national debate about free speech. It was articulated as a free speech event by Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer, despite the fact, Steve, that the keynote speaker at the event, the Dutch politician Geert Wilders, has advocated banning the Quran. So it's unclear to me why it would be an event about free speech when the person at the center of the event is someone who wants to ban a religious book.
Nathan, let me read you an excerpt from an essay called The Islamophobia Myth. This admittedly came out, I think, it's 10 years old already, but Kenan Malik wrote it, and here's some of what he has to say. Does Islamophobia really exist, or is the hatred and abuse of Muslims being exaggerated to suit politicians' needs and silence the critics of Islam? The trouble with Islamophobia is that it is an irrational concept. It confuses hatred of and discrimination against Muslims on the one hand with criticism of Islam on the other. The charge of Islamophobia is all too often used not to highlight racism, but to stifle criticism. And in reality, discrimination against Muslims is not as great as is often perceived, but criticism of Islam should be greater. What's your reaction to that, Nathan?
Well, first of all, Islamophobia is not a new phenomenon. The word Islamophobia dates back to 1910. So this is an old prejudice that we're talking about. It was first used by two authors who referred to the way in which Muslims in West Africa were treated by French colonizers. The second point I would make, though, is I think necessary. It's necessary to kind of get the straw man out of the way here. Criticism of Islam is not a problem. Criticism of Muslim acts of violence around the world is certainly not a problem and should be expected from all of us. The problem, though, which I think Kenan Malik doesn't quite seem to understand, is twofold. First, when criticism of Islam or when criticism of Muslims ventures into the direction of misattribution, of generalization, or of reductionism, these logical fallacies where we make claims about things like Sharia law and then apply them writ large to the entire religion of Islam, or we take one or two acts of violence carried out by people around the world and then attribute that to the religion of Islam, that is where we get ourselves headed in the direction of prejudice and potentially, when it's acted upon, discrimination. I think it's quite unhelpful.
I know you mentioned in that list of people who you thought was behind this Islamophobia industry, you talked about academics, you talked about guest speakers like Geller and Spencer. I'd like to focus just a little bit now on politics and the media because, of course, we all know that a lot more people are going to die in traffic accidents than through terrorism, and yet not too many people, let me not put it that way, let me say there seem to be many fewer people who are concerned about what's going to happen to them when they get behind the wheel of a car than potentially seeing harm come to them in terms of a terrorist incident. How culpable do you think media and politics are, separately or together, in perpetuating this Islamophobia industry that you've written about?
Well, quite frankly, I think they're extraordinarily culpable. I think part of the problem, though, is our tendency to focus on what I've called a foreign enemy domestic threat. phenomenon. So instead of talking about things that are happening right here at home, mass shootings in movie theaters, the killing of unarmed black men by white police officers, which seems to be a sort of new normal here in the United States, we're talking about acts of violence that occur around the world carried out by Muslims or Muslim groups, and then using those acts as sort of a reason to connect the dots and say, aha, look, something like this could happen here. Now, that's not to deny the fact that groups like ISIS and others that carry out violence, extraordinary violence all around the world are real, and that violence is real, and it should be acted upon, and we should deal with it. The issue, though, is when we don't really kind of examine the things that are right here in front of us at home, and we tend to focus on violence as it happens across the world, from across the Muslim majority world, especially from Morocco to Bahrain, and then sort of make a logical leap where we're saying, hey, look, there was an attack in Casablanca. Hey, look, there was an attack in Yemen. This too can happen in the United States, and this is a reason, therefore, for us to amp up our security. This is a reason for us to profile people based on their religious affiliation at the airport. This is a reason for us to conduct wiretapping, mass surveillance of mosques, and many of the, I think, un-American practices that we see carried out all the time.
Nathan, we've got a couple of minutes left here, and I want to touch on one more thing. I have no doubt but that you've seen this clip, but just in case some of our viewers have not, this is Sam Harris, the author, and Ben Affleck on Bill Maher's program Real Time on HBO. Started as a rather mild-mannered debate, and it turned into something else. Roll the clip, please.
We have been sold this meme of Islamophobia, where every criticism of the doctrine of Islam gets conflated with bigotry toward Muslims as people.
Right.
And that is it's intellectually ridiculous. Even it gets
conflated
with racism.
So hold on, are you the person who understands the officially codified doctrine of Islam? You're the interpreter of that,
I'm actually well-educated on this topic.
I'm asking you. You're saying that Islamophobia is not a real thing. That if you're critical of something...
It's not a real thing when we do it.
Right.
Well, no, it really isn't. I'm not denying that certain people are bigoted against Muslims as people. That's a problem.
That's big of you.
But why are you so hostile about this concept?
It's gross. It's racist. Okay. Or how about more than a billion people who aren't fanatical, who don't punch women, who just want to go to the store?
Wait a second.
Okay, in terms of the Islamophobia industry, Nathan, how significant do you think that exchange was?
I think it was extraordinarily significant, but mostly for the fact that you have a celebrity figure like Ben Affleck bringing attention to an issue that's very real. I think the sad thing, though, about Bill Maher is that Bill Maher is really wonderful to a lot of progressives or so-called liberals on a whole host of issues. But when it comes to Islam, he and his pal Sam Harris seem to want to tag team and make these claims that are quite honestly baseless and illogical. The thing for Affleck, though, is that he wasn't so articulate in how he responded to the remarks that were off base by Maher and by Harris. Both of whom engaged, I think, in reductionism, which is one of the sort of logical fallacies that I cited earlier. That is, that they cite these extraordinarily extreme examples, and of those examples, cite the most extreme cases. So, for instance, when they talk about something like Sharia or Islamic law, they don't talk about the way that Sharia or Islamic law might deal with, for instance, marriage disputes, or the way that it might deal with sort of other family matters. They talk about hand chopping and stoning and you know, the death penalty for apostasy as it's carried out by a minority of countries across the Muslim majority world. But, drawing, I think, further from that, they take these extraordinarily extreme examples and then make a generalized statement about Islam. These are problems that Muslims have to deal with. This is an essentially Islamic problem. What I think they don't understand is that in addition to engaging in the logical fallacy of reductionism, their critique, and it's fine, again, to be critical of the tenets of Islam, is actually viewed by many Muslims around the world as a critique of their identity. Bill Maher seems to kind of think that religions are things that are just kind of floating around, above our heads, that they're a set of ideas that are sort of disconnected from who we are as people. And because they're ideas, as he says, the motherlode of bad ideas, or Sam Harris, as the motherlode of bad ideas, that we can critique them, not understanding that these are actually very central parts of people's identity, and that Muslims all around the world believe that their religion informs how they view the world around them, how they interact with their family, how they interact with their friends, how they find meaning and give value to their lives. And so when we sort of obsess on these extreme examples and critique them and say, look, these are things that are Islamic in nature, these are things that Muslims have to deal with, I think we begin to venture into an area that's more along the lines of prejudice than it is really objective liberal critique.
That's Nathan Lean. He's the author of The Islamophobia Industry. Nathan, we thank you for joining us from Washington, D.C. on TVO tonight. Take care.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit supporttvo.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.